This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Coming up on the program today, the last 5 days in the life of the American economy. What exactly makes a junk bond junk? And spaceships and Hollywood to round things out. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is finally Friday, the 14th of November. Great, as always, to have you with us. We will get going today with a recap, a summation, an analysis of the economic week that was. For that, we've got Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine, also Sudeep Reddy from The Wall Street Journal. Hello to you both.
Hi, Kai.
All right, Lee, we'll start with you. I want to go back a couple of days and this big settlement by the big banks on charges that they conspired to manipulate the foreign exchange markets to their own profit, a $5 trillion market, by the by. I guess the question is, come on, really? We're still dealing with banking scandals?
I know. It really seems, could this really be happening?
Yeah.
And it's pretty, I mean, if you look at the emails, it's the proof is right there, and it's just... it doesn't look very good. And it's funny. I read somewhere this week that somebody said that, oh, journalists are excited about this. The markets are not. You know, the markets didn't really react. But it's a pretty big deal. And it just means we have to get control of this. We have to make it so that this can't happen, because it's just looking like the kind of natural watermark for the financial industry is not looking very good.
Sudeep, it does not inspire confidence, I would offer, in the ability of the financial industry to keep an eye on itself.
It doesn't. We're not even at the end of these investigations. Yeah. We've seen $200 billion in penalties just from the last crisis, and who knows what kind of crisis we're creating right now.
Right. That's all crisis, not just this one. That's all investigations, not just this one.
Exactly. Yeah. Not just this one. That's all of these built together, and we're obviously, when regulators and enforcement officials plug holes, others are left open, and they will be exploited, and we know that's going to happen. So we're now, while plugging the old holes, waiting for the investigations that are going to be occurring 5 years from now due to current activity.
All right, let's stay in Washington, Sudeep, and I want to talk about the news from yesterday that the president is apparently thinking about doing something on immigration by executive order. The Republicans, of course, say, no, 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 don't do that. At risk would seem to be budget negotiations. Are we now going to have budget negotiations like every 3 months with this divided Congress and the way things are going?
They're certainly going to be a little more volatile than they have been. We had a period where most lawmakers were willing to at least defer their fights on the budget and defer their fights on some of these issues because they wanted to get to an election. And we probably only have a year before they're willing to wait for the 2016 election. But that's a long year. We have to go through a little bit more drama on the budget and a potential shutdown, a little bit more drama on a debt default. Everybody who is responsible says these things aren't going to happen. But we know that they are their pressure points. They're going to at least lead to some kind of negotiation along the way because of the control of Congress now.
Yeah. Lee, our working theory around here the day after the elections was, you know what, Wall Street and businesses are going to be fine because this basically means Congress will not be able to foul up the American economy. Do you think that still holds after 10 days, which has been rancorous?
You know, I don't know. I mean, there was this 24-hour window where it really seemed like, you know what, the single message, this election was not about electing for anything to actually happen. It was an end to the gridlock. That was resoundingly the message, and that's what everybody wants. And, you know, here we are again already talking about these tactics again, and it just feels like Groundhog Day.
Lovely. All right. A word here on behalf of the American consumer. Retail sales came out this morning. They were up. Oil is It seems headed, Sudeep, for a consistently low, relatively low price, and that, you know, plays out in consumers' pocketbooks and all that. Could this be, could the oil prices falling be a boon for consumers that might really help things substantively?
It certainly could be the thing that saves us from going down the tubes like everyone else is facing in the world.
Like the whole
right
rest
now.
Of the world, yeah.
Like, look at Europe. Look at what's happening in China.
Right.
There's a lot of bad stuff happening in the world that probably should have washed on our shores by now. The fact that consumers are going to have they're getting their raise through the gas tank instead of through their employers, that's at least something to give us some cushion for the next few months, hoping the rest of the world gets better.
That's a really good line, actually. Lee, what do you think? Is it are consumers actually going to benefit here in the longer term?
I think they will. I mean, and we don't know what's going to happen to oil. Is it going to go further still? I mean, that is definitely goes right to consumers' pockets. Mm-hmm. And then we also saw some other good news this week that wasn't really noted, that there were more than 5 million people hired in September for the first time since 2007.
I missed that.
And yeah. And that is, you know, that there is some bright news on the job front, too. So I would take those two things kind of in tandem.
All right. We will do that. Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine and Sudeep Reddy from The Wall Street Journal. See you guys.
See you, Kai.
All right, have a good weekend. Wall Street today was, you know, some ups, some downs, same as always. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Twitter took a little bit of a financial wallop yesterday. Standard & Poor's downgraded its credit rating to BB-, or in plain English, junk bond status, which, even though that is plain English, still requires a bit of explanation. Marketplace's Adrian Hill has it.
Twitter is junk. J-U-N-K, junk, junkety, junkety, junk. However you say it, it sounds bad.
Junk is a kind of a colloquial term. Probably the more professional term is non-investment grade.
Thomas Lease is a professor at Northwestern's Kellogg School of Management. He says the word junk oversells things.
If the headline read, S&P rates Twitter below investment grade, people wouldn't be jumping quite as much at the headline as junk.
I call up Robert Neal, a finance professor at the Kelly School of Business at Indiana University.
Junk makes it sound like I should just toss it in the trash. Is that what I ought to be doing?
Oh, no,
Basically, a junk credit status, he says, means a company's debt is high compared to its earnings.
The rating agencies are less certain that Twitter is going to be able to make its debt payments.
On the scale of junk credit ratings, Twitter's BB- isn't that stinky. But it's smelly enough that some investors will stay away. David Cass is a professor at the Robert H. Smith School of Business at the University of Maryland.
Many institutions, such as pension funds, are restricted that they can only invest in investment-grade bonds.
Fewer investors and the lower credit rating mean Twitter will pay more to borrow money from those lenders out there willing to hold their nose. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
For those who think their cars are a refuge, that we can't see you when you're singing at the top of your lungs as you drive along, or doing your makeup or shaving at a traffic light, first of all, we can see you. Second of all, this next story is for you. A group of 11 big car makers has come out with a set of consumer privacy protection guidelines. In essence, they promise that, don't worry, there will be limits to the ways in which their cars will spy on us and who will get the information that they collect. They include rules for geolocation, where you are. Also, information on driver behavior, like how fast you drive, whether you're wearing a seatbelt, and biometric data as well. How creepy will the cars of the future be? Marketplace's Dan Weissman has that story.
A modern car is already a computer. It records all kinds of stuff. Take it to the mechanic, he plugs into a port and gets diagnostics.
That data used to be in your car. You went into the dealer, he had to plug in. It wasn't being sent anywhere.
That's Jules Polonetsky from the Future of Privacy Forum. Now that cars can connect directly to the internet, there's more data to float out there. Some of that data is already floating. Lori Rectanis wrote a Government Accountability Office report on location-based services in cars.
You're driving along and advertisements will come up for certain hotels that we use. We look at that. We go, how did they know that? How did they know that we would be interested in that?
She says the GAO did not find GPS navigation companies selling consumer location data to advertisers, but they could, and they could get hacked. Li Tian is an attorney with the Electronic Frontier Foundation. He asks, what if you're going to Planned Parenthood or an AA meeting? Or what if the car could record what you and your passenger are doing and saying?
Coworkers, colleagues, friends, family, a lot of conversations, a lot of activity inside the car.
There's also the question of how you drive. You want your car to be able to issue a speeding ticket? The new privacy principles don't impress Ed Markey. He's a U.S. senator from Massachusetts who's pushed for federal legislation to protect privacy in cars. Yes, the principles make some promises not to share information with just anyone. However,
principles do not provide consumers with a choice whether sensitive information is collected in the first place.
If you don't want anyone to track you through your phone, you can always turn it off. In Chicago, I'm Dan Weissman from Marketplace.
There is nothing quite as motivating as a good rivalry. Think about Bill Gates and Steve Jobs, or Coke and Pepsi, Ford and Chrysler, Nike and Adidas. Those are two of the biggest sports brands in the world. And yet there is one area where Adidas is a decided underdog: basketball. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson takes a look at a new push by the company to take on long-dominant Nike on the court.
Nice cut.
There's this public basketball court in Manhattan known as The Cage. It's smaller than regulation, hugged by a chain-link fence, and it's famous for a more physical style of play. Just scanning the court, it's clear Nikes are the preferred shoe at a weekend pickup game. Who are you wearing for shoes?
Nike high tops.
Yeah, I'm wearing Nike shoes. I think they're the Kobe Bryant 4s.
Nikes. I collect basketball shoes. I still have my Jordans, the first ones. I still have a brand new pair in the box.
I haven't worn anything but Nikes in 10, 15 years. But I like Adidas too, though.
That's a spark of good news for Adidas, but Nike has a crazy high share of the basketball shoe market, well over 90%, which means Adidas has a lot of work to do to be a real contender. Chris Grancio is the general manager for Adidas's global basketball division. He says the company refocused, making basketball a priority a few years ago. They're the league's official sponsor.
But I would say, you know, as a brand that, you know, has aspirations to be the leading basketball brand in the world, we haven't grown fast enough.
To get that growth, the company wants to build shoes around some of the league's biggest players. But it's as uncertain a process for Adidas as picking stocks is for investors. They signed megastar Derrick Rose back in 2012, but he's been plagued by injuries. So this summer, Adidas got particularly aggressive, signing four of the top six picks in an especially strong draft class: Andrew Wiggins, Joel Embiid, Dante Exum, and Marcus Smart.
Knowing that we've got half the starting point guards in the NBA now wearing Adidas, and the fact that we've got five or six or eight guys that we think could really be, you know, not only all-stars, but could be really special players, that has to be part of our approach. There is no silver bullet for us. We have to continuously be looking for, you know, the next great player.
What that actually reminds me of is exactly what Nike did about 20 years ago.
Victor Matheson is a sports economist at the College of the Holy Cross. He's actually talking about Nike's move into soccer.
So the World Cup final of 1994 is underway. Brazil in their famous yellow shirts attacking the...
Nike wasn't a player at all in the soccer markets around the world, and they started to make a concerted effort in about the mid-1990s to become a big player worldwide in soccer, and they started to try to assign the top stars and the top teams around the world.
Matheson says the roles were reversed back then. It was Adidas who was dominant in soccer. Nike was the underdog. This World Cup, they were neck and neck. Going back even further, signing a mega player worked for Nike in basketball, too. Remember this guy?
Michael Jordan down the lane, left side, jammed it with the right hand. That was Air Jordan, nonstop from roughly the broken circle on in.
The biggest piece that threw Nike into basically national prominence was the Air Jordan, the great basketball shoe.
Everyone wanted to be like Mike, and they still do. Even today, Air Jordans alone are nearly 50% of the basketball shoe market, and they're owned by Nike.
You want your brand associated with top players. You want your logo seen on those top players.
Rocket science, it is not. But Jack Plunkett, CEO of Plunkett Research, says endorsements work. So Adidas is making the right moves.
I think Nike's so far ahead, though, in some ways. They're presenting a huge challenge to the industry. And so, I mean, I would hate to be in a position of taking Nike on head on.
But he's not saying Adidas shouldn't try.
I know they are a global brand with great financial power and, you know, they're smart people. And I just think it's a big challenge for them.
In New York, I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Coming up, never accuse an engineer of not having a good imagination.
Actually, engineers are incredibly creative people. I mean, that's what engineering is.
That was Gwynne Shotwell, the president of SpaceX, from our last live road show. We'll get there in a second, but first, let's do the numbers. Kind of quiet today, actually. The Dow Industrials gave back about 18 points, a 10th percent, closed at 17,634. The NASDAQ bumped up 8 points, almost 0.2%, finished at 4688. The S&P 500 up just a fraction of a point, 0.02%, ended things at 2,039. For the week gone by, the Dow and the S&P both put on about 0.4%. The NASDAQ was up 1.2%. In corporate news, there are merger talks, apparently, between the two big players in the oil services biz, two of them anyway. Baker Hughes and its bigger rival Halliburton are thinking about teaming up. Baker Hughes shares up almost 2% today. Halliburton traded up 2.4%. The industry leader, Schlumberger, also up about a 0.5% today. Profit was up at Nordstrom. The high-end retailer said it was helped by opening new stores and by buying the men's apparel company Trunk Club. Shares up 1.25%. Shares in Pandora Media, you know, the internet radio service, streamed up 16%. That after a vote of confidence by the company's CEO, who just bought 25,000 shares of the company. You are listening to Marketplace.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. The Federal Reserve issues its industrial production report for October. The U.S. Postal Service starts delivering packages 7 days a week in some areas through Christmas Day. And on November 17th, 1800, Congress convened in Washington for the first time in its new home, the Capitol Building, which was still under construction. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. It's been widely reported, both here and elsewhere, that ISIS and the Islamic State are the richest terrorist group there has ever been. Looting and control of big chunks of the oil-producing parts of Syria and Iraq have left them flush with cash. So now they are going to put that cash to use, if you will. Announcements on jihadi websites say ISIS is going to start minting its own currency, gold, silver, and copper coins, to be precise, said to be based on the Islamic dinar used during the Caliphate of Uthman in 634. There are some logistical hurdles, to be sure, how to get the gold and silver they would need, how to mint and distribute the coins. But assuming they can do all that, could the whole idea actually work? Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has that story.
On the face of it, this idea sounds pretty out there. No paper currency backed by a sovereign state's economy and central bank, just coins, gold, silver, copper, worth what the metal itself is worth.
It would be a pretty weird, difficult system to manage.
That's Ted Truman at the Peterson Institute for International Economics.
Prices of bread and so forth would go up and down with the price of copper or gold or silver on the global market. A unit today would buy one loaf of bread, and tomorrow, half a loaf of bread.
Spreading panic and hoarding because people wouldn't know how much food or gasoline the coins their boss paid them today would buy tomorrow. And then there's the problem of trade. It's based on systems of credit and banking, not gold and silver coins, says Penn State business professor Faribors Gadar. And ISIS trades plenty in food and weapons and black market oil.
Imagine somebody wants to buy wheat from a trader in Iraq and wants to use it in Damascus. Does that mean then you have to put gold in a truck and ship it and exchange it with the wheat that's coming? And then what happens if on the middle of the road somebody steals your gold?
There may be an advantage to minting your own currency to create collectible coins for supporters around the world. That might be plenty of return on investment for ISIS. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
The last in our series of live stage shows was this past weekend. It was called How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Numbers. We wrap things up with a couple of conversations about creativity in business. Franklin Leonard, the founder and CEO of The Blacklist, was with us. The Blacklist started about a decade ago as an unscientific survey of the best unproduced movies of each year. Now it's a going concern and a for-profit operation. We also had Gwynne Shotwell, the president and COO of Elon Musk's other company, besides Tesla, that is, SpaceX, which is so far best known for its contracts with NASA to resupply the International Space Station. So far, best known. Here's Gwynne Shotwell to start things off.
We have these crazy, audacious goals. Really, what we're focused on now is building up enough revenue and having enough money to develop the capability to take people to Mars.
Mars?
Mars.
If Elon came to you and said, do you want to go? What would you say?
So I don't like to camp. And
all right, and if early they had on, a habitat.
Early on, Mars is going to be camping.
Yeah.
So I think there are people far better suited than me to do that initially.
Yeah.
You know, but when the first Holiday Inn Express shows up, maybe I'll go.
It's interesting that you are in this business of which you don't necessarily want to partake.
Well, I'd love to go to space.
Yeah.
But that's different from an 8-month trip.
Yeah.
In a bus, and you're heading to Mars. And what happens if you get there and you don't like it?
Yeah, it's 8 months back.
Eight months back.
There's no Uber back.
How long until you get people up into space? How long until you're carrying people?
A couple years.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. Whoa. That's cool. That's cool. You both had careers in other fields before you found what you are doing now and have been doing for a long time. You were a consultant at McKinsey.
That's right.
How did that change your approach to what you do now in business creativity?
You know, right out of college, I sort of did three different things very quickly. I ran a congressional campaign in Ohio or helped run a congressional campaign. I was a writer for a newspaper in Trinidad, and then I was at McKinsey for 2 years. And I've never been one to sort of very dogmatic about, oh, well, the way things have always been done is the way things should be done. And I think I probably brought a lot of different approaches from previous jobs into the environments and jobs that I've had now and said, well, what if we did things this way? Why aren't things done this way? And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't.
Right.
Sometimes there is a reason why things have always been done this way.
Which actually brings me to the rocket scientists, right? I mean, these guys have checklists and they are engineers, so they think like this. Does that impede you as you try to get them to think, listen, we need to figure out a way to make this rocket 47 pounds lighter?
Actually, engineers are incredibly creative people. I mean, that's what engineering is.
Well, there you go. That'll show me.
We have a house full of engineers. How awesome.
That's right.
I don't feel like I've ever had to, like, push my team to go think of bigger and better things. It's kind of what they do naturally. Engineers are driven to do things better, really to the point of being annoying a lot of times, actually.
Yeah, I'm not hearing a lot of applause for that, by the way. Do you think you can learn creativity? And obviously it's a different ball game for the two of you than it is for them, right? Gwen?
I think you can be taught kind of the definitely you're taught the engineering process, which I guess is a process of creativity. So, yeah, I think you can be taught that. Hmm. Whether you could do it well is a different issue.
Right. And you are, we should say, you're a mechanical engineer and,
yes.
And what? Applied mathematics is the other.
Correct. Yeah. Which is engineering analysis.
Okay. I'm like a history political science guy. I don't know anything about that stuff. What do you think?
I think, yes, you can teach creativity. And I think on some level, teaching is about, like, sort of decalcifying the brain, right? Like, I think, like, all kids are really creative. And I think on some level, as we grow older, we take certain things for granted and we assume certain things and assume that certain things aren't possible and that things can only be done a certain way. And so a lot of it is like, I think, getting back to being a little bit more childlike and sort of allowing yourself to believe that anything's possible, and then it's just a matter of figuring out how to do that. But ask me tomorrow and I'll have a completely different answer. So
we know what the disruption of the blacklist is, right? It's that crowdsourcing of it and then developing the business model from that and then getting the people to pay attention. What was the creative disruption for SpaceX?
It was enormous. It was an industry that was kind of mired in bureaucracy, lacked innovation. Things cost way too much. They take way too long. And so we break into the market and develop rockets at a tenth or more of what others have done, which really changes the entire value proposition of putting things in space. And people were angry about that.
Well, explain that a little bit.
Yeah.
It's tough to be creative in the face of people, you know, saying lousy things about you in the present.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. You know, it's an entrenched industry. It's been safe for the big players up till now.
Right.
It's awesome.
Franklin Leonard and Gwen Shotwell. Thank you guys so much.
That was obviously just a slice of what we talked about. We went about a half an hour on stage. Our whole conversation with Gwen and Franklin is going to push out on our podcast today. If you are already a subscriber to said podcast, well, that's excellent. Thank you. If you're not, please go sign up at marketplace.org. Also visit our website. Photos, interviews from all of the roadshows, you'll find them all there.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out today, in which we learn, and not for the first time, that the financial industry really is different. Bloomberg had the story today about legendary bond trader Bill Gross and his paycheck last year. Gross left his firm, PIMCO, a couple of months ago, but he left with plenty of walking around money in his pocket. Gross is the co-founder of PIMCO, and he got $290 million last year as a year-end bonus. $290 million. PIMCO says Bloomberg got it all wrong, that it wasn't $290 million in his bonus envelope. All right, there you have it. On a Friday, the Dow gave back 18 points today, about a 10%, closed at 17,634. The NASDAQ up 8 points, almost 0.2%. The S&P 500 up just a fraction to 0.1%, if you really want to know the details. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace was developed by J.J. Orr. The program is produced by Sitar Nieves. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer. I'm Kai Ryssdal. We will see you Monday, everybody. Have yourselves a great weekend. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.